This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is Resource Centre. My name is Majidah Hashim. So in the past, management theory has always been primarily concerned with how to create success. Lately, however, there has been more and more interest in understanding organisational failures and decline. How does an organisation get into a state of decline? Is this a people issue or a leadership problem? Why do people lower in the organisation have to suffer decisions made by top management? To investigate further into organisational failure, we welcome back to the studio Dr. Rosan Othman, author, management consultant and trainer with over 30 years of experience in management research. Doctor, what is organisational decline and why does this happen?
Organisational decline, in brief, is sustained poor performance. It can begin even before a company or an organisation incurs financial loss. Of course, the ultimate manifestation is when the company experiences financial loss, leading to sometimes even bankruptcy, closing down of the business. If you look at the way people behave, leaders tend to attribute this to external factors, the economy, you know, customers not understanding their product, or competitors who are jealous. So generally, they tend to attribute to external factors. But in reality, a lot of the causes of decline are actually internal. The external market will always change, but not every change leads to failure of all organizations. Some are able to survive, some cannot survive those changes. So decline happens when organizations cannot adapt to many of these changes in the external environment. So as a result, they spiral downwards. And as they experience this decline in performance, they can't seem to arrest the decline. Now, organizations, all organizations will from time to time have setbacks. The difference between decline and short-term performance setbacks is that those companies who are able to identify the root cause of their problems and actually intervene to remedy the situation will be able to actually avoid the sustained decline.
How does an organization know if this decline is caused by an internal factor or an external factor? How do they make the differentiation?
Okay, understanding or realizing that you are experiencing decline can be difficult simply because quite often management in the organization can suffer from this frog in a frying pan syndrome, whereby you turn up the heat slowly and the frog doesn't realize that it is actually the water is beginning to boil, and as a result it gets scalded in the frying pan. Usually what happens, as I've mentioned earlier, the external environment will change because there will always be competitors, there will be points of inflection, changes in technology, regulatory environment, and even the economy. The difference is whether the management is able to actually make the necessary adaptations. Now, organizations that fail to adapt usually has the tendency to escalate commitment to bad decisions. So instead of asking themselves, how do we change and how do we adapt, they kept on believing that they have to do more of the same, keep on repeating doing what they've always done. And a lot of this is reflective of the insularity that has developed. And as I've mentioned in our discussion earlier on competency trap, decline happens after you succeed. Okay. If you never succeeded, there's no decline in the first place. So organizations that go through decline usually have experienced decline after they've actually succeeded. And what happens is people tend to develop formulas for success that they keep on replicating. And in order to sustain the formula for success, it tends to create a certain equilibrium within the organization. And the only way that equilibrium can be changed is when top management recognize that the current equilibrium is no longer sustainable. Now, if top management is in denial, keep on thinking that they can keep on doing the same thing and hoping that things will get better, then that's when they will actually experience a sustained decline and ultimately failure.
How can organizations avoid falling into this trap?
There are a number of things that organizations need to do. One of the important things is to always identify the toughest competitor and always benchmark against those competitors. That way, you do not allow yourself to be complacent. Look at your toughest competitor and see how their moves will affect you, and always be mindful of the response. To sort of take an example of an organization that basically failed to do it is a company called Faceit. is a Swedish company that was established in the 1920s. And it was basically a market leader in producing mechanical calculators. Now, I'm not so sure if you are old enough to remember mechanical calculators. Your generation probably were born with digital calculators. But basically, Faceit was the global leader in terms of mechanical calculators. Now, the ironic thing is that when digital calculators started appearing in the market, the company did not adapt to that new challenge. Okay, so much that what happened was, and this was the irony of the situation, when they were designing new models, their engineers would actually resort to using digital calculators, electronic calculators, to confirm the calculation of their mechanical calculators.
Oh.
And they never realized that this new technology is going to basically make their product obsolete. I suspect there was a bit of a competing view in the company because in 1965, or was it 1967, they did actually develop an alliance with Sharp in Japan to sell Sharp calculators in Sweden. Okay, but the thing is that in spite of having done that, they could not let go of their commitment and investment in their capabilities that's related to their mechanical calculators. So by the 1970s, they were just no longer sustainable and the company basically just closed down. So that's an example of a company that saw the writing on the walls, you know. Their engineers were using the competing technology and yet they could not come to terms in terms of making the adaptation. So that is where, if you look at the individual engineers, they were probably doing their job very well, the engineers, you know, as far as coming up with more accurate mechanical calculators, because now they can confirm their calculation using electronic calculators. But at the strategic level, they failed to actually redefine their business.
So this is a case of not the followers who are adapting to new technology, but the leaders who are in denial over what's going to come.
Indeed. And this is the paradox. Whenever a company faces problem, who gets job offers?
Well, not the leaders.
Yeah, not the leaders. Yeah. Obviously not the leaders. At least they'll be hanging around for a few more years before things get real bad. The downsizing will affect the guys who are lower down the hierarchy. Right?
Yeah.
They are the one who gets removed first. Even though they may be doing their job right, you know, but they may not be doing the right job.
Right.
Yet that decision is a decision that has to be made by top management. And when top management fails in addressing that issue, that's where you will see that companies will experience decline. Now, the other thing that's also related to this problem is a phenomenon called managerial hubris. Hubris is when you become very confident of yourself, become self-conceited, to the point where you think you cannot do wrong. So you keep on making bad decisions, thinking that it will be right, thinking that, you know, if there are mistakes, it's someone else's fault. I mean, you can see this in Donald Trump, for instance. It is always someone else's problem. And there have been incidences. For instance, if you look at the history of Compaq, before it was acquired by, merged with HP, at one time, Compaq was the biggest PC company, okay? And the then CEO, Eckhard Pfeffer, became so obsessed with actually growth. He wanted Compaq to become the biggest PC company. In order to pursue those goals, he made sure that he basically kept people who disagree with him outside his circle. So much so that at the HQ, the executive level, where the CEO and the president was located, was basically out of bounds to those from other levels in the organization. And so much that when Compaq decided to acquire digital equipment, even other members of top management were not aware of the decision. They only read about it in the media the next day. Okay. And of course, that turned out to be the disaster for Compaq. They couldn't integrate the two companies, and actually led to the decline in performance and finally the removal of Eckhard Pfeffer from the CEO position of Compaq.
How can organizations recognize the early signs of decline and what can they do about it before it's too late? Stay tuned right here on Resource Center on Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments, BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
And And we are back on Resource Center on Enterprise. My name is Majda Hashim. Today I'm talking with Dr. Rosan Othman about organizational decline, a phenomenon where an organization experiences sustained deterioration in performance. Before the break, we spoke about the nature of decline itself, how an organization's leadership itself is a major contributing factor to this, and what an organization goes through as it experiences decline. Are there any early signs or early indications that an organization is about to go into a state of decline?
Some of the things that you will see is when they start developing a fairly rigid culture, you know. The culture is a product of past success, as I've mentioned earlier, past formula that work. But the moment things started changing, people start treating all of these habits, processes, entrenched procedures as sacred. You know, you cannot change them. Why? Because this is how we've always done things. And you will see people using this kind of reasoning from time to time to justify not taking action. Or we've made this commitment before, therefore we cannot change our decision now. So because of that, bad decisions are followed up with even more bad decision. And a manifestation of this cultural rigidity is when people start becoming more concerned with form rather than substance. Being able to celebrate small achievement, exaggerating the significance of small achievements, and then ignoring fundamental problems. Sometimes people try to create the sense that we are doing okay by having rituals, ceremonies, you know, praising the leader. Mm. I'd like to bring an example from politics. When the White House brought in this new guy as its communication director, Scaramucci, or better known as Mooch, if you look at his statements, that's what he was doing. Praising Trump at every opportunity, praising, saying something very positive and all that. Not addressing the fundamental issues, you know.
Okay.
And the same thing happens with organizations. You will see in one instance, and this is the case of a public listed company in Malaysia, they had this new managing director. One of the things that he did was to start appointing advisors and special advisors. Last count, at that time, he appointed as many as 15 advisors.
Wow.
What do these advisors do? Give him all the good news, make him feel important. But more damaging is the fact that these advisors, the moment you appoint people as advisors, they are not so sure what's their responsibility actually. So what do? They start interfering in the responsibilities of other functional managers. And as a result, there were a lot of conflict within the organization. It so happened that at that time I had several students in my MBA class who were from this particular company. And at that time, you were seeing many people in the middle management actually quitting the company because they just couldn't stand the interference from these 15 advisors. So that's an example of the kind of a cultural rigidity, form replacing substance, and that actually leads to a kind of an insular outlook amongst members of top management. So it became very counterproductive, and finally, the managing director was basically removed and replaced with someone else.
What can an organization do in order to avoid this kind of decline if they know that these signs are taking place?
One is to keep people accountable for results. Generally, as a general rule, do not appoint individuals into positions and you're not so sure what they're supposed to do. You know, you're not so sure whether they are cost center, profit center, revenue center, because that becomes problematic. They will be there consuming organizational resources. And if they're not so sure what they're supposed to deliver, sometimes they end up interfering with the job of other people. They get in the way of other people. So make sure everyone is clear of what they're accountable for. So that way everyone becomes oriented towards actually at least delivering some level of performance. Second is when you're to create units within the organizations, same thing. Make sure the units are clear what they are accountable for. Okay, so both at the individual and units. Because sometimes organizations may create functions that no one is sure what they are doing there. I've seen in some organizations, they are even competing units trying to do the same thing. Largely because there's some amount of distrust between members of top management, or sometimes the CEO doesn't trust the SVP, for instance. So it creates a parallel mechanism within the organization that then people start stepping on each other's toes, and instead of doing something productive, they end up competing with one another. The other thing is to make communication swift and easy. Okay, be physically and mentally open. Now, why do I say be physically and mentally open? Some leaders go through this charade of proclaiming that they have open door leadership. So I remember some time ago talking to a consultant, medical consultant at a particular hospital. And I was saying to him, I heard that your hospital director has this very modern outlook, you know, open door leadership. And the comment that I got from him was, yeah, his doors are open, but unfortunately his minds are not open. Yeah. You can go and talk whatever, but he will not listen to whatever you're saying. So people sometimes confuse, you know, between the artifacts of a good management, good leadership, and the substance of good leadership. And this is partly is what I mentioned earlier about form replacing substance. Now, communication, our experience at human capital development in terms of doing change management consulting, we found that in most of the cases that we were involved, the most fundamental problem is there was no effective communication within the organization in terms of what the change is supposed to be about. And leaders often confuse. They think if they have town hall meeting once a year, Hari Raya open house once a year, or family day once a year, then that's it. Everybody understands their vision. You know, when you're facing a challenge, it takes more than just a 1 hour of platitude, you know, or one ritual or one ceremony, launching ceremony, to get people to understand what the new challenges are, how they have to realign their behavior, their performance to actually support the change and deal with the challenges. So communication, you know, I like to sort of point out to people who attend my training program, if you want to understand, just look at how wives and husbands misunderstand one another. They think they're communicating, but they never really understand one another. So amplify that by multiple times in organizations. You know why? Because people don't plan to communicate effectively.
What leadership qualities should they have so that they can avoid this kind of decline?
The most fundamental quality is that leaders have to be vigilant. And being vigilant means being close to customers and being close to your own people. As I said, in the case of IBM in the 1990s, people lower down the hierarchy were aware of the changes within the environment. But people at the higher level of the organization were slow to respond to many of these changes. So if you look at some of the examples of leaders who basically model these behaviors, for instance, Tony Fernandez has a reputation for actually going around, even working with his baggage handler, check-in counter. That way he understands what's actually happening in the organization. Jack Welch, for instance, one of his habits whenever he goes to any of the subsidiary or any of the plants, before he meets with the management of the subsidiary or the plant, he'll go and talk to the lowest level employees in the organization because they are the one who will tell you the real problem. And having understood that from the lowest level employees, when he go and meet top management of the plant or the subsidiary, they basically can, you know, cover things up because he already knows what's happening. So because of that, you force people to be truthful. Another example of a leader who exemplified this is Soichiro Honda, the founder of Honda. He is very much the model of what we call the kind of leader who engages in Gemba walk. Now, in Japanese management, this whole notion of Gemba walk. Gemba is simply a Japanese term for where action happens or where work is done. So these are leaders who are basically who walk around on the factory floor, meet with lower-level employees. If there are problems, they will solve it there and then, you know, instead of waiting for a report to come. And I remember talking to the plant director of here in Puchong, who practices the Gemba walk and the lean production system. He said, if you go through the traditional process of waiting for report, it will probably take a week, maybe 2 weeks for people to write up the report. The report will be so thick, it will take you maybe 1 or 2 days to just read through the report. As a result, by the time you take action, the problem has amplified itself over maybe 1 week. So with Gemba walk, you are there looking at the problem, dealing with it there and then. And from the point of view of the morale of the employees, they feel the sense of closeness with management. They feel that, you know, they are heard And this is one of the things that also help to boost their motivation. So these are the kind of things that also helps to make sure that the leaders are vigilant of what's happening on the ground. Because some leaders don't even understand what's happening in their own backyard. Because they're so insulated, as I said, by layers of advisors, by corporate headquarters that's located in a penthouse. The rest of the operation is somewhere else in a different location. So they become very detached from the reality that they are facing. The other thing that I think leaders have to be able to do as part of strategic thinking is the ability to frame and reframe the competitive issues. Okay, framing is about understanding your current situation. What is the reality? Okay, reframing is about questioning back, what the future should be. So it is an exercise that involves people, requires people to rethink their approaches, rethink their assumption. It's not an easy process, but it requires a lot of debate and involvement with other members of the organization to look for threats as well as new opportunities that the organization should take advantage of.
Thank you, Dr. Ruslan, for speaking to me today. I've been speaking to author, management consultant and trainer, Dr. Ruslan Othman, on organizational decline. And if you missed any part of this interview, don't worry. Just go ahead and download the podcast on our website at bfm.my, or better yet, on the BFM mobile app, available now on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. My name is Majia Hashim for Resource Center on Enterprise, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.